the night has come and the land is dark and the moon is the only light we'll see. No, I won't be afraid. Oh, I won't be afraid just as long as you stand by me. So darling, darling, stand by me. Oh, stand by me. Oh, stand by me. Stand by me. If the sky that we look upon should tumble and fall, or the mountain should crumble to the sea, I won't cry, I won't cry, no, I won't shed a tear, just as long as you stand by me.
Premier Radio Networks presents Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
Through the ages, people have been reporting weeping statues, icons. You can see tears coming down from these statues. In some cases, it looks like blood. Other cases, oil, whatever it may be. Also, incredible, incredible paranormal stories as well. The old hag syndrome, that continues to come up, does it not? How about people who walk by streetlights? They go on, they go off. What causes that? In a moment, our guest, Brandi Stark, on Coast to Coast AM. Brandi Stark's interest in the paranormal began in her childhood but came to fruition while she was attending college. Her graduate work focused on the role of ghosts in religions from Mesopotamian epic of Gilgamesh through the Greco-Roman world to the Middle Ages and to the modern world as well. Her basic premise remains that the recorded works and images of ghosts expands through all known human thought and cultures. To further study the paranormal, she co-founded the Spirits of St. Petersburg in 2000. This investigation group focuses upon the ghostly phenomena of the greater Tampa Bay area, but also she's investigated other spiritual phenomena such as crystal bowl meditation, the Mary manifestation of Clearwater, and the weeping icons in Tarpon Springs. She continues to study the supernatural and is currently working on two books featuring the topic of ghosts. Our guest tonight on Coast to Coast, Brandi Stark. Hi, Brandi. How are you?
I'm all right. And yourself?
Good, good. You're also a contributor to After Dark once in a while, are you not?
On occasion.
Yes, you do. You do a great job, by the way.
Thank you.
Now, how did you get interested beyond your childhood of paranormal work? How did you get interested in ghosts?
Well, I found myself, particularly as a child, interested in religion, and as I grew older, also interested in the paranormal, and the two really go hand in hand. I really did not realize the extent of that until I was an adult. Ghosts used to scare me silly when I was a child. I couldn't handle the ghost stories. I'd be petrified at night. So it took some maturing of my own mind. But ultimately, when I was an undergraduate, I started doing research on the role of ghosts. And I actually attended a couple of academic forums presenting papers on the role of ghosts in Greece and the role of ghosts in Rome. And I found it to be so fascinating. It was such an underdeveloped topic. And as I went to graduate school, I continued to develop that topic, and I spent all of my graduate and postgraduate years working on the role of ghosts in religion in the humanities. And I found it to be absolutely an incredible journey, quite frankly.
There are so many facets of ghosts and apparitions I want to talk with you about tonight, Brandi, you know, including, you know, going by streetlights for people.
Absolutely.
The old hag syndrome, and especially weeping statues and icons as mm-hmm. well. But there's always a confusion in terms of the kinds of ghosts that we're talking about. So why don't we just very quickly come up with some definitions so we can understand, especially with a program like this, when people call in and say, you know, I'm in a house that's haunted, or there's a poltergeist here. We're talking about different things, aren't we?
That's correct. Basically, as an academic study, what I had to state, academics may tend to have some liberal ideals, but I could not state that ghosts existed, but I had to say that ghosts had a role in culture, in society. But in order to work with the paranormal, I like to have my parameters defined. So basically there are anywhere from 5 to 6 different types of ghostly phenomena out there that I primarily work with. Two are, believe it or not, ghosts of the living, the so-called out-of-body experiences.
All right.
One type of out-of-body experience is involuntary. This is when something traumatic is happening to an individual, they're thinking of loved ones, and somehow they project their minds to that loved one, to that person who receives the mind, who sees the person standing there, sometimes as a faceless form, but they know who it is.
Now, does that person who's done the accidental OBE,
mm-hmm.
does that person know they've done this?
Sometimes they do and sometimes they don't, and that's what's so interesting. Usually this is such a intense moment, such a shocking moment that people may or may not remember the actual phenomena, but one of my very favorite examples is a story that I've heard from World War II where a pilot's plane was going down in the war, and he was thinking so intensely of his family that even though it was 2 o'clock in the morning, his sister awoke thinking of him, looked at her bedroom door, and saw this faceless form of her brother who was dressed in piloting clothes. And she knew who it was. She was wise enough, she was smart enough to make note of what happened. But the next day she found out that her brother's plane had gone down. Now, he did survive, but it was still quite remarkable because she had seen the apparition at the time that the plane was going down. And he did admit that, you know, those last-minute thoughts as the plane's going down, he was thinking much of his sister that he left behind, yeah.
So that's called the accidental OBE.
Yes.
All right. What else? You said there are two living ghost-type things. What's the other one?
The second is more of a perhaps a religious or a trained person who intentionally sends out their minds. These are kind of like the senescents or the sadhus, the mystical, very well-trained meditators who can send their mind forth and who intentionally travel from place to place or person to person.
So people who are trained with the ability to do OBEs, you'd put in that category?
I would.
Okay. Now, those are, of course, the living. What about the dead?
Now, these are the ones that I find most fascinating. There are at least two different types of ghosts themselves. What I term an apparition is probably what most people think of as ghosts. These are your fully functioning, fully interactive entities, moving things, trying to let you know that they're there, usually wanting some sort of acknowledgement and that interact with the living. There is your standard haunting, which is always a very interesting phenomena, where it's almost as if there's a recording in the surroundings. It's like there's a psychic impression left in a building that people of sensitivity are able to turn on, and they're able to see this recording. Usually these types of ghosts, this type of haunting, is repeated over and over again without change. So if every night at midnight you see a man dressed in a kilt walk through your kitchen and through a door and he vanishes, that most likely is some sort of haunting. There's no interaction, no acknowledgement.
Would that be the same then for people, for example, when they go to Gettysburg and they see Civil War ghosts just kind of marching by? Would that be the same category?
Most likely. Now, Gettysburg is kind of a very complex situation because it's so very haunted and so very bloody, quite frankly. That was a very intense time period in history. We do know that there are some apparitions. There are entities that will talk to the living. There was at least one reported case in which a woman was watching what she thought were reenactments when one of the entities came up to her and said, "You need to move back, this isn't safe." Which, admittedly, if that were to happen, I would take the advice and definitely move out of the way. But
that would be more of an apparition then.
That is an apparition. Yeah. But if you're seeing, for example, on the anniversary of a major battle in Gettysburg and you see the army marching out, They don't change expression. They don't acknowledge people. It's something that happens on an anniversary. Then most likely that is more of a haunting.
Okay, but an apparition is like a ghost that really gets involved with whatever you're doing as a human being, I guess.
Correct.
Right?
As a paranormal investigator, those are the ones we find most often. That's what we're called in for. And the third type of ghost is actually pretty interesting, very common, believe it or not, but it's known as a crisis apparition.
Now, what's that?
Now, crisis apparition, they actually go all the way back to the Homeric time period. We do find an example of a crisis apparition, believe it or not, in Virgil's Aeneid. I'm a classicist as well, and so I will plug the epics and be happy with that. But ultimately what that is a one-time apparition that shows up to relay some sort of very important information. Believe it or not, a lot of times we get these sort of stories from widows or parents who have recently died, their children who are trying to put their estates in order. If something's missing, all of a sudden they will see their deceased parent and the parent will give them information. I have a family friend who was very involved with her husband who died pretty suddenly. She was quite devastated by this death. And she was kind of in the midst of her grieving. She was trying to get everything put into order, all of his paperwork and all of his possessions, and she could not find these particular family heirlooms that he always treasured and valued. And she searched everywhere. And she remembers just sitting down on the couch and trying to kind of relax a little bit when all of a sudden, now she may have fallen asleep, but this is still pretty interesting, when all of a sudden she realized that she wasn't alone and her husband was in the room, and he said, "Sweetie, you need to go and check this suit that hangs in the closet." And she looked at him and she said, "But you never wore that suit." And he said, "Check the pockets." And the next thing she knew, she was alone again. She went to the closet, checked the pockets, and by golly, there were the missing family heirlooms.
Is that the same thing too, Brandy, when people have been reporting getting phone calls, they think, from the dead?
Phone calls from the dead, now that's a great category, and I would love to continue doing more research on that. The advent of technology is a great thing, but phone calls from the dead, yes, potentially that's what's going on. This is where somebody dials a number trying to reach a friend, and they speak with the friend for a number of minutes. They call the number back, and the friend's been dead for 2 years.
Or it shows up on caller ID as 1111111.
Yes, or they get this mysterious number, or they answer the phone and there's this strange whispering, or they hear the dead trying to communicate with them as if it's a bad connection. That could be a crisis apparition. I hadn't thought about it that way, but I like that, yes.
What about the ghost? What's the ghost called then that scares people, that's out there, and it's not friendly? It could be considered interactive, so it could be an apparition. Apparitions could be good or bad, right?
Correct.
Okay, but there are other ones that just, they don't want to leave. What are they?
Usually I would classify those as apparitions in the sense that they have made a conscious choice after death not to cross over to the other side, not to fully cross over. There's something that may, in fact, be much more of a strong definition of what most people think of as a ghost versus a spirit. A spirit is something that is a person that has crossed over and comes back, but has chosen to come back, whereas a ghost is much more earthbound. They are afraid to cross over, and we have, in fact, done a couple of investigations recently dealing with, believe it or not, a couple of suicides. And it's very interesting because during the investigation, I actually did ask, because this entity was kind of an unusual, it was being very unusual, and I asked, "Did you commit suicide?" We're trying to figure out what had happened, what the last life memory was. And the reaction to that was so extreme that the video camera that I was carrying, it shut down instantly. And I've had that happen twice.
That's weird.
It's with the suicides. And very angry, very unhappy entities. Usually I would just classify those as being negative. And my opinion is that an apparition is very similar to a person, just as each of us is an individual in the living world, so too are we individual in the non-living world. So I do know people in life that are quite negative, and you read the newspapers and you'll find those same harmful entities in life that you find in death.
I've got a friend out here. His name's Mark Victor, and he wrote the movie script for the movie Poltergeist.
Oh, yeah.
And I hear a lot about poltergeists, but I want to hear from you what you think they are.
I have my personal opinion is that a poltergeist needs a human agent. The idea of a poltergeist is that a poltergeist basically means a noisy ghost. Geist is ghost in German. And ultimately what happens is it is something that creates chaos, movement, scratching, discomfort, usually for the living. It can start fires. It can pelt the house with stones. I mean, these stories go back very far, actually. They go back to at least the Middle Ages, if not further back.
Uh-huh.
And the interesting thing with a poltergeist is that usually there is a human agent involved.
Now, what do you mean by that?
Essentially, there is a teenager, a young person of some sort.
Okay, like the movie?
Yes. In the sense that a teenager or a younger person is experiencing very intensive bodily, emotional, spiritual changes, they create all of this ambient energy that they can channel subconsciously. This fear is channeled subconsciously into kind of like psychokinetic bursts of energy.
Do they become the victim?
They oftentimes do. And that's what I found so interesting about poltergeists. Now, the other idea is that a poltergeist is indeed a separate entity from humanity, but that they are attracted by this energy and therefore settle with the human agent.
Are poltergeists out there to hurt, harm people?
Typically, they seem to be pretty angry, and I would definitely call in for assistance with a heavy-duty poltergeist. Oftentimes, there's one theory that says that it's the very Freudian theory. I think this is pretty Victorian, but the idea that there is repressed sexual tension, fear of adulthood, this unsettled sensation. And with that fear, usually, yes, there is going to be some sort of negativity.
Now, in your organization, which you put together called Spirits of St. Petersburg,
mm-hmm.
your group investigates ghostly phenomena around the greater Tampa Bay area, right?
Correct.
How widespread is that?
Well, right now we're counting that as Tampa, St. Petersburg, and Sarasota, and a little bit of Pasco. In fact, we've headed out that way. We have done several investigations on the other side of Florida in the Casa Dega area, Lake Helen, and Orlando. But the greater Tampa Bay area, with Pinellas County, is pretty well, very well, in fact, populated at present. And, of course, Florida has the reputation of being, God's waiting room, so to speak. And with such a heavily packed county, we actually get quite a bit of work. It's very interesting to see, particularly in Florida, that we have all of this wonderful natural energy that's going through this area. We're a peninsular state already, so we have all this ocean around us. St. Petersburg, in addition, is a peninsula off a peninsula, so we've got even more water. We have an aquifer going underneath the state, creating most likely natural ley lines. And we also have a heck of a lot of lightning. So we have all of this ambient energy that already coexists and exists in Florida. We also have a pretty old history going back to pre-Civil War time period here.
You sure do.
Plus the indigenous cultures that were here, the Kaluska, Tuckabagawin, and Miccosukee, those type of tribes that unfortunately were wiped out basically with the landing of the Spanish. The cultures are entirely extinct at this point.
Do you think energy is necessary in order for ghosts to basically survive?
I believe so. I've always had the question, can a ghost exist if there are no living things around it? My opinion is that they cannot. I think that they really do draw upon the energy of the living. I guess it's the same idea as if a tree falls in the forest, does it make a sound? If a ghost exists and there are no living people around it to receive it, to acknowledge it, or to give it energy, does it truly exist? The natural energy is certainly one way for a ghost to form, to give it a basic existence, but I have found, and part of the reason why I created the group, is that the more people you have involved during a paranormal investigation, usually the stronger the entity reacts.
When we come back at the break, Brandy, I want you to tell us about some of your investigations, some things that happened that maybe even frightened you and your group. And, okay. And then I want to talk about the old hag syndrome as well. And then the next hour, what we'll do is we'll talk about weeping icons because some of these stories are absolutely incredible. And then a lot of you continue to call into Coast to Coast about walking past streetlights, or you drive past them, and they go on and they go off. And, of course, some of them could be directly related to the eye that is in the light itself that goes on and off when it sees light. Maybe it sees a reflection of your headlights of your car or something like that. But some other people have said, no, I'm simply walking by and this happens. Maybe there's something to it. We'll be back in a moment with our guest Brandi Stark on Coast to Coast AM.
Want to time travel? Go back to past shows on Streamlink. Sign up online at coasttocoastam.com.
My monster from his slab began to rise, and suddenly, to my surprise,
He did the monster mash.
It was a graveyard smash.
He did the mash.
It caught on in a flash.
He did the mash.
He did the monster mash. From my laboratory in the castle east to the master bedroom where the vampires feast, the ghouls all came from their humble abode to get a jolt from my electrode.
They did the mash.
They did the monster mash.
The monster mash.
It was a graveyard smash.
They did the mash.
It caught on in a flash.
They did the mash.
They did the monster mash. The zombies.
This is Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
The After Dark newsletter comes out every month, but right now they are giving you two free issues, 14 for the price of 12, when you subscribe and order. Call this number, 1-888-727-5505, this full-color magazine, or go online, coasttocoastam.com. Again, the phone number is toll-free. Operators are there now. You can become a member of the After Dark Reading Club by getting this. 14 issues for the price of 12. 1-888-727-5505 online. CoastToCoastAM.com. Brandi, in your investigations or anybody from your group, do you ever come across something that was just downright scary?
Yes, actually, on occasion we have. Typically, these are, the more negative entities that we've come across. We've had a few that have thrown things at us or have moved things. Kind of exciting stuff, but definitely want to stay on the good side. And in fact, it's very interesting because even while I'm talking with you, I have some of my my equipment out. I've oftentimes found that when I speak about ghosts in general, believe it or not, I start getting phenomena. And in fact, I did a ghost lecture last night in Dunedin, Florida, and started getting massive phenomena. My EMF meter is out, and even while we were talking about poltergeists, it was certainly going. And I've not seen the meter do this too often.
That's strange. So. They follow you?
Well, entities have the potential of following. I don't know if they follow me necessarily, but it is oftentimes said that particularly people who are interested in them, who talk about them, who are more open to them, tend to attract ghosts. So I kind of leave that open. I'm not size sensitive, so I'm quite happy in that state. But I do have my equipment, and I have learned to study it over the years. And I've had this meter for a while, and it's definitely acting up a bit tonight.
Interesting.
Yes. Hey.
Take us through an investigation. What do you do? How do you set up the equipment? What kind of equipment do you use?
Okay, well, the Spirits of St. Petersburg really tries for a dignity and integrity and respect for the potential deceased as well as the living. And so ultimately what we do is there's one person who's a contact who gets the information. I actually am usually the contact, but I have something that's known as a homeowner's document, which lists phenomena for homeowners to check off. We usually do have to ask somewhat personal information, which we don't share, but things along the lines of, is the homeowner on any form of medication, or, is alcohol a factor with these manifestations?
Right.
But kind of the general information. Ultimately, I take that information and I seal it away. The next thing that we do is we find a date that works well for the homeowner and for us. Ultimately, the rest of the team is invited on the investigation, but they are not given the address or homeowner name until a couple of hours before the investigation. The only thing they have is a general crossroad, the major crossing street, so that they know exactly what the approximate location is, if not the location itself. So usually one person goes in knowing anything that's going on. And I'm not always the contact, so I've also gotten to go in cold so that I have no background or information. But to keep anyone from spilling information, we have a standard procedure in which we essentially break into groups of three. Oftentimes, it's very important to remain within these groups because if you're a person like myself, I get so involved with this equipment, I'm paying attention with the equipment, I'm trying to coordinate an investigation that I do have people who tell me, if you keep moving forward, you're going to walk into the coffee table, So it's important to have people helping each other out and keeping an eye on each other. Plus, if something does happen, you want as many eyes as possible present. And I've oftentimes found that if you only have two people, there's a possibility that one will miss something. And so if you have two, at least the odds are a bit higher that more than one person will witness. It's also a protection for us because we can witness each other in the sense that I can vouch for the team that they're not setting anything up. They can vouch for me that I'm not setting anything up, which is pretty important.
Sure is.
Afterwards, we basically have the procedure of going to the furthest point in our groups of three and moving forward and then ultimately trading spots in what's called a silent walkthrough, in which folks are writing down sensations, readings, any abnormal or natural readings are called out, light switches, EMF from older refrigerators, computer screens that are older, that type of thing, so that we know the natural boundaries. Where energy is naturally emitted, and we'll know where our readings might be negated. Afterwards, we come back together, starting in kind of an orderly fashion. Each person reads their notes to the rest of the group, and we decide what areas are the most active. We return to those areas, and we do our investigation pretty much concentrated in those areas. We've had to do that because pretty much everybody on the spirits team has a day job, and the homeowners also have day jobs, and our investigation started stretching into hours and hours and hours and hours. So this kind of keeps it condensed to a nice 3-hour time span. It also can be very draining to do these investigations where, particularly in an active entity, it's hard to describe, but definitely there's an energy transfer going on. Ultimately, we investigate those areas. We come back. Actually, we're communicating with each other as we're investigating these hot spots of activity. Size sensitives are going. Our equipment is going. We try and get as much information, as many eyes as possible working with this. We come back together. We tell the homeowner first what we have discovered. I then read off the homeowner's document, and then the homeowner tells us what we have or have not hit upon. And it seems to work very well. We're trying to kind of cover as much as we can in a short amount of time, also trying to keep the investigations very neutral. We will come back to a location, oftentimes investigating it 2 to 3 times to see if we can find natural occurrences, things that are repeated, things that we can rule out as natural phenomena. And ultimately, after the first investigation, oftentimes there's a historical research. I have various group members who have connections and are very good researchers on the area.
Right.
And we try and discover if there's any overlapping history that correlates with the investigation. And it tends to work very, very well for us.
When you do this in with the kinds of equipment that you have, do you get results right away?
Oftentimes, yes. Normally what we will do is we'll open and close an investigation. Now, the spirits of St. Petersburg does not really invoke or evoke, and we do not do exorcisms. So we're really there as a documenter. Essentially, also to keep us kind of on the straight and narrow, I do have an open call out in the greater Tampa Bay and Florida area, really, for non-haunted houses. Usually, since I'm the contact, I'm the only one that has any idea as to what is going on. And because the group knows that most often we are called into a location, I have found that this works to keep us from becoming expectant, that we're always going to expect to find a haunting, because you toss in these random non-haunted houses, you perform the exact same procedure, and it's quite amazing to see what happens. Half the time I'll have people coming up to me saying, and I can't, you know, there's no way to tell anybody anything. The good thing about ghost hunting and paranormal investigation is you learn to have a good poker face.
Absolutely. Have you ever felt, though, unwelcome by the entity?
Yes. On occasion, definitely so. We had one entity that was basically of a religious background, that there is no such thing as a ghost, could not figure out why it was there and did not want us there and did not want to talk to us because what we were doing was, in its opinion, completely wrong. There is a standing rule. We are not there to antagonize anybody, and if the entity becomes angry or hostile, normally we kind of back off. A couple of times we've been able to kind of talk the entity down in the sense of calming
it down. It's smart to back off. Not nice to upset a ghost, is it?
No. If you're dealing with the supernatural, always remain on the side of caution and try and make sure that it's happy when you leave.
What's the most violent you've ever witnessed or even heard about in a ghost story?
Oh, well, there was one investigation that was extremely active, again, with actually there were a couple. Again, these both dealt with suicide. Now, we've had a third suicidal case in which the entity was completely harmless, but she wanted her art displayed. The only time she became upset was when her art was taken down and something else was put up, and she would start pulling these things off the wall, which
really?
Was interesting.
They would just fly off the wall?
Yeah, they would pop off the nails, and the nails wouldn't hold them, and the wires would snap, and so the homeowners would put her work back up.
And everything calmed down?
Yes. Mm-hmm. It was basically, it was a niece of the homeowner, and she'd always been kind of a black sheep of the family, as was the homeowner himself, much more of an artistic type, and she evidently found out she had signs and symptoms of a pretty severe mental illness and committed suicide.
Oh, gee.
Yeah, and ultimately, though, she always felt very attracted to the uncle in the sense that she understood him and he understood her because they were both artistic.
She was comfortable with him.
Yes, exactly. And so that was a really pretty interesting investigation. We have, again, recently done one where the entity was very strange. It was almost a trickster in the sense that it was basically not admitting to a suicide but was afraid to cross over. It was a very strange investigation. Sensitives kept mentioning they felt like there was something else there, but it wasn't revealing itself. I did not set up this particular investigation, but towards the end we discovered that the homeowner basically has been plagued with this entity, with a series of entities for the past three homes, and they are not friendly. She had stuff thrown at her. She had boxes moved. They would cook her food, which may or may not be a bad thing, I suppose, but not in a friendly sense anyhow. If you're trying to make your own lunch and all of a sudden it's cooking itself. We did not witness that, but allegedly that's what happened in the first house. She was just absolutely terrified, exhausted, fatigued, and these entities just kept following her, really putting her into kind of a victimized stance. Ultimately, our advice to her was to continue to ask it to leave, to continue working with, in this particular case, because of her religious background, a priest, and to continue working on her own defenses, because she just she would work with this entity and try and get rid of it for a while, and then she would stop, and it would come back stronger than ever.
These entities, in your experience, have you come to a point now, Brandy, where you have your own theories on just what these are? And I'm not talking about, you know, the spirit of a dead person or something that hasn't moved on, but in general, just what are they? I mean, are they part of the universe? Is this a natural thing? Is it supposed to be this way?
Well, speaking in a religious sense, and I myself, I am a professor of religions at present, and what I have adored studying.
How many hats do you have, anyway?
Oh, you have no idea. It's kind of an interesting life that I live, but I usually have to remain quite neutral, and I obviously cannot discuss ghosts in my classes for the most part, but it's very interesting because ghosts do answer, religiously speaking, they do answer a question, and that question is, what happens when we die? Is there an afterlife? Now, this may not be the ideal afterlife, but it is an answer to, is there an afterlife? And in this point, it would be yes. It's also a taboo. Most religions cite that ghosts are things that, particularly in the West, Western religions don't really deal well with ghosts, see them as negative entities. The East, it depends on the type of ghost. You have your honorable ancestral spirits, and then you have entities that are killed, murdered, very angry, vengeful sorts. But my opinion is that essentially, yes, they are a part of the universe. They are part of existence. I have no doubt personally in an afterlife, and I think that they are certainly one form of proof of that afterlife. Just kind of what I usually call corporally challenged, an individual who exists without the body. And of course, the whole point of existence is that we are ground into a body, and so it's this enigmatic figure, this existence of consciousness beyond the physical realm.
Do they make sounds to the point where you can hear them not on tape, mm-hmm. not on video, but that you actually can hear them?
Well, I myself, again, am not a size sensitive, but on occasion, yes. I had one investigation where I heard somebody say quite clearly over my shoulder, "Oh, you're here." Okay, yes, we are. Yes, basically that would relate to the clairaudial senses, which most people state are behind the ear. It's part of the brain or part of the mind that relates to the area of the brain behind the ear. And yes, there are people that hear them quite clearly. I work with sensitives that I can ask a sensitive a question, and the sensitive will hear the answer.
Where did we ever get the feeling that ghosts would go ooh and things like that? I mean, was that Hollywood? How did that all happen?
Actually, if you go far enough back, I believe it's Cicero. I'll have to double check, but I believe it is Cicero who writes. Roman Cicero, mind you, this is Roman Republic Cicero, so he's way back in the.
We're going
the
way back, yeah.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. There is a wonderful Roman ghost story, and it talks about a man who was a student, and I have been a student, still am a student, doesn't matter where you are, you're always a student, but he was a basically something like a college student in ancient Rome, and he needed a place to stay. And so what he did was he rented this cottage. And this is a tip I usually give to anybody. If you're getting a house and all of a sudden you find this house in the middle of a wonderful district that has really low rent that you can't really explain, you might want to pay attention. You might want to ask a little bit more of the history because, by golly, this young man rents the house. He goes in, and the landlord on the day that he moves in says, "You need to be really careful because it's supposed to be haunted." Now, he's a student. He's skeptical, and he says, "No, there's no such thing as ghosts." Well, that night he's studying his letters. When all of a sudden he feels a presence, and he looks up, and there's this old man, this spectral old man who's bound in chains, and he's moaning and groaning, and he goes closer and closer to the student. And I don't know how the student does this. Personally, I don't think I could, but he remains composed. He ignores the ghost, continues his studies. This happens three nights in a row until finally the young man decides what he's going to do is he's going to follow the ghost and see where he goes. And again, this ghost is moaning and groaning and very upset and distraught. Well, the young man has figured out that according to Roman culture, if the body is not properly disposed of, if it's not given an appropriate burial and or cremation,
right,
depending upon the time of Rome, the entity cannot cross over to the other side. It is impossible. The grave is a hugely important factor in the ghost story. And he basically follows the ghost out to ultimately an unmarked grave where the ghost vanishes. He digs it up. He digs up this grave, and he discovers this skeleton wrapped in chains. And by golly, the ghost himself was dragging behind him all these chains. And so he had been a victim of murder. And so what he did was to let the landlord know, and they conduct a proper and appropriate burial for these bones, and the ghost disappears.
Do you ever talk to children and who have ghost stories?
I have.
They're so innocent, aren't they?
They are very innocent, and I tend to urge caution when speaking with children because it depends on the child. Some children are quite comfortable with the ghosts. Others are quite terrified, and you know, I don't want them to become afraid. My personal opinion is that we've come into this world, and therefore we are going out. I mean, that's death is an aspect of life. It's what defines life in some respects. And ghosts are a simple result of that going out of life. They are a continued existence. But I have a hard time even talking with adults about that. Our culture is particularly in the West, in some respects, we're afraid of death.
Do you have any doubts at all that there is a hereafter?
None. No. Essentially, I have experienced enough at this point. I have had the hand on the shoulder. I've had an 8-pound Bible fly off a shelf horizontally. It moved out 63 inches. We measured it, and it landed at my feet. I flipped the Bible over, and it was open to a page that had an image of what was called the Resurrection Cave. My grandmother, she was technically a very strong family friend, but she was the woman that should have been my grandmother.
Yeah.
It's one of those bonds. And 2 hours after she died and 4 hours before I was told she had died, I was awakened in the middle of the night with a sense of complete and utter peace, a wonderful fragrant aroma, and I knew that she was dead. And the thought was it was okay. And she was, in fact, she was my first paranormal experience. And ironically, it was after about 15 days after I graduated with my master's degree. And she was just such a warm and loving person. And we had talked about ghosts. Unfortunately, in some respects in the West, we don't have as established a system as there is in the East of working with people through the process of death and dying. We're starting, absolutely. But she really didn't have anyone to work with, and so we would sit up, and she knew my degrees, and she loved it, and we would talk about death and dying, and I really think this was her way of saying, you know, yes, there really is something on the other side, because she was so afraid at one point that this is a complete reversal.
That was her signal.
Yes.
Stay with us, Brandy. When we come back, we'll pick it up by talking about the old hag syndrome. I'll be back in a moment.
Subscribe to After Dark. Call toll-free 1-888-727-5505.